information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight we care.
Appear to border
and it shows.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nine you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Everybody's talking about the stormy weather and what's a man to do but work out weather. It's true. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 236 from Media Monarchy. It's October 21st, 2011. And this is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups this week. Stormy weather, riots, Gaddafi gone, and Operation Occupy. Pill hostages, wild animal die-offs, and the all-good news purge. Plus ops, apps, and agony on cyberspace war, co-ops, bailouts, and the gateway bug on food world order, camping Parsons and the King James versions on holy hexes. Plus sound ideas and so very much more, my friends. Episode 236, October 21st, 2011, MediaMonarchy.com.
not to at least just give us a clue. Ah, oh, here it comes. I know it's someone I knew. Teenage riot in a public station. Gonna fight and tear it up in a hibernation for you. Now I see it. I think I'll leave it out of the way. It's not true, what you paid the way. We're looking for a ride to your secret location. With your kids are setting up a piece of incubation for you. Got a fog on and a drum and a hammer that's rocking. And a board and a pedal and a lock that'll do you for now. It better work out. Hope it works out my way. Cause it's getting kind of quiet in my city head. It takes a teenage ride to get me out of bed right now. You better look it. We're gonna shake it up to him. He acts the hero. On his
released 23 years ago this month, Sonic Youth, Teenage Riot, the debut single from their 1988 magnum opus, Daydream Nation. It's even in the National Recording Registry in the Library of Congress. And someday we shall be as well, my friends. This is the 236th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's October 21st, 2011. And my name's James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, cover-ups, and so very much more. And we are broadcasting live, as always, my friends, live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And, of course, a huge thanks to the stations that simulcast this show live, ZeroPointRadio.com and RevereRadio.net. They've been hanging with Media Monarchy for a long time, and I appreciate them so much. We've been thrown out a mention in the last few weeks of our latest affiliate, KDXRadio.com, rebroadcasting Media Monarchy Saturday nights at 10 p.m. Central Time. And again, a huge thanks to all the other alternative media outlets who play this show or otherwise spread the word about Media Monarchy. All our episodes, audio, video, and otherwise, are on either radioforall.net and or archive.org. And a huge thanks to the Tragedy and Hope community, tragedyandhope.com. And we are on FaceSpace, Twitter, Tube, Tumblr, Gmail, Skype, all the other social nets with Media Monarchy as your keyword. A huge thanks to Stephen in British Columbia for his donation to Media Monarchy in the past week. If you find independent, commercial-free, non-corporate alternative media, if it enriches your life, if you get a kick out of it, show some love, show some donation love. We've got the button on the top right of the page. Your support helps keep this going and growing and moving and grooving and everything. A lot of donations from Canada. You're pretty awesome, Canada. As we look at the breaking news, as we always do, we leave the page open to see what's happening as we are broadcasting live. So many things to try and keep up with. It's impossible to do it in the one-man band form that I am under the banner of Media Monarchy. But I do my best to go through tons of news and to provide a broad section of what's going on the main show game stage, as well as behind the scenes, subtext, context, and hopefully we can make better decisions. Obama announces full withdrawal from Iraq 8 minutes ago from USA Today. President Obama confirmed plans to have all U.S. troops out of Iraq by January 1st, formally ending the war that began more than 8.5 years ago and, of course, has taken more than 4,400 American lives, not to count the tens of thousands of other shattered lives and the millions of other murdered lives. Balancing his body count image, highest body count of most Nobel Peace Prize winners. Syria, Yemen, opposition buoyed by Gaddafi's death. 29 minutes ago from the BBC, Libya plans secret Gaddafi burial. Will new food labels mean better choices? Could exotic animals be returned to the Ohio zookeeper's wife? Netflix profit expected to rise in tough period. Plus Taylor Swift, Tim Burton, the mobile industry, Mitt Romney, Justin Timberlake, and so very much more on your breaking news. As we try and put it all together, as there is some sort of sinister force, predictive programming, some kind of mass black magic. And it all plays out right in front of our eyes, and all we have to do is kind of look and we see the pieces. So yes, Obama softening his war criminal peace prize image. You have to follow up the murder of yet another leader with quotes around it. So he can turn around and say, oh, we're fully withdrawn from Iraq, and that's, of course, not going to count the thousands of secret advisors and black ops and other intelligence operatives who, of course, are the bread and butter of these fake coups and overthrows that we've seen in the Western Empire ever since, oh, it seems, the National Security Act in 1947. And then we started to launch coups and covert intel-backed overthrows of Iran and Guatemala and Chile and on and on. What makes you think for a second this is any different than all of those throughout the years? And probably you don't, if you're listening to this show. And again, we have wide open arms. We're nonpartisan here. We don't play the Patriot games. Welcome to wherever you are in the world, however you are receiving this transmission. It's episode 236, October 21st, 2011. Let's get it. Portland protests Condoleezza Rice at university fundraiser on October 19th. Condoleezza Rice spoke at a Portland State University fundraiser. Some Portlanders were on hand to remind the people of the previous puppet administration's war crimes, as we're being blinded by the current puppet administration's war crimes. And I got a little bit of video, posted it up quickly. It's just a little bit of raw video, threw some music over top of it because it was garbled iPod video. But a huge thanks to you who shot that video, and we got it up on youtube.com/MediaMonarchy, and we put it on the archive, and if you are subscribed to the feeds, you got it in your podcatcher already, my friends. The music was by Strange Letter. StrangeLetter.net. We also have the latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com, episode 88, Fukushima Updates, Hyperlink Libel, and Athens Austerity. First story we cover on the weekly video series between myself and James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, 20-plus radioactive hotspots found in Tokyo, all due to citizens' measurements. There is related video of top Japanese official discussing these hot spots. And an interesting related point in that is related to the attack, again with quotes around it, on nuclear plants. And we saw Stuxnet. And we, of course, learned that it was created by U.S. Real. And now we see ABC News with a hat tip to blacklistednews.com warning of the sun of Stuxnet. Researchers warn of impending Dooku cyber attack. That's D-U-Q-U. And I didn't know. Corbett did. That's somebody from Star Wars. Our second story, Canada's Supreme Court rules internet links not liable. And we get it from the Toronto Star, and we have it posted to cyberspacewar.com. And our third story, citizens swarm Greek streets in whirl of violence, from the Intel Hub. And we have updates from the French Agency Press and the Los Angeles Times, and even a flashback to a previous episode of New World Next Week, going back to June of this year, where we discussed the financial collapse of Greece as the canary in the coal mine for the global economy. So I implore you to check out NewWorldNextWeek.com. I think it's a great show. I think James Corbett does fantastic work, and I'm proud to be a part of it. It's the great thing that you can, I think, get any type of person to check it out who, as I've said, may not listen to a two-hour podcast of some jerk talking over dub reggae. But that brings us to all the latest from CorbettReport.com, posted along with episode 204, A Brief History of CIA Drug Running. From the Golden Triangle to the Golden Crescent, from its early origins to its current operations, the Central Intelligence Agency has long been immersed in the murky underworld of drug trafficking. Episode 204 digs up some of the skulls and bones in the CIA's closet in Burma, Laos, Afghanistan, Mexico, and beyond. And you can get more on this story from the eye-opener at BoilingFrogsPost.com. Sibel Edmonds doing fantastic work. We also have posted up all the other latest audios, videos from CorbettReport.com, the War on Whistleblowers, with the aforementioned Sibel Edmonds on Global Research TV, Dr. David Kelly and the Battle for an Inquest, and introducing, as we mentioned on the latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com, FukushimaUpdate.com, the brand new site from James Corbett covering, dedicating itself to the nuclear nightmare in Japan. So there are articles and videos and so much swirling around the Fukushima update. It's also on Twitter, at Fukushima Update. Interviews, videos with nuclear expert Arne Gunderson. The Fall of the Nuclear Priesthood. As well as other audio interviews with Bob Chapman, Bill Conroy, Christopher Porter, Lawrence McCurry, Joseph Trento, Morgan Lesko, Joe Loria, Eric Dion, and so much more. CorbettReport.com. And that takes us to PeaceRevolution.org, where episode 42 is the part two of the ultimate history lesson. You may recall last week we discussed with episode 41 of the number one higher education show on Podomatic, PeaceRevolution.org. The ultimate history lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, is a coming soon DVD interview project. And all the information will be available to you as soon as it's ready to launch, as soon as the widgets go up, as soon as it's ready to spread out there for everyone, as we can, again, try and learn our way forward. So this episode 42 of PeaceRevolution.org is the second hour of the Ultimate History Lesson with John Taylor Gatto, where you're just getting the audio. And again, the amazing multi-DVD video package is coming soon from Peace Revolution and TragedyAndHope.com. I was able this week to catch up a little bit on my Ground Zero listening. Clyde Lewis used to only be on Sunday nights here in Portland. 2 hours. Now he's on every weeknight for 3 hours, and I'll admit it's hard to catch them all. I always find myself remembering, oh God, he's on again. But I caught it a couple times this week, and I love the way Clyde is able to kind of tap into the strange signs and symbols and, yes, memes and more. The occult, the paranormal, the parapolitical. It's done in such a fantastic way, and again, I provide all the links for you. You can listen live, you can subscribe to the podcast, you can follow on Twitter, at Clyde Lewis, at KXL News, and we always post up all the latest articles. Pulling the Vampire Trigger, The Call and Return of the Zombie, Turn Me On, Dead Man, getting into Lennon, Beatle, Fall, McCartney lore, and very much more. Praying for Death, and as we mentioned last week, new videos on Ground Zero TV. YouTube.com/HarryScary23, and the latest videos get into real-life vampires that we have covered on this show, my friends. We've discussed the cases in Florida recently surrounding the strangeness of people claiming to be vampires or werewolves, even. And there's a video, Ground Zero behind the scenes, getting into killer clowns. So, as coming soon from GroundZeroMedia.org and the Ground Zero Lounge presents The Ghosts of John Wayne Gacy on October 30th, you may recall a couple of weeks ago we reported in our Murder and Mayhem coverage that they are reopening and re-examining DNA in the John Wayne Gacy serial murder cases. And then on Halloween night, October 31st, Phone Calls to the Dead. Yes, my friends, paranormal, occult, pop culture, predictive programming, all that and so much more from Clyde Lewis and GroundZeroMedia.org. That is a quick blast through some of my favorite alternative media that I'm happy enough to be associated with in some way. And if you enjoy this show, I guarantee you should get something out of those shows as well, because I think we all, in some way, whether consciously or subconsciously, kind of inform each other's work and are fired up and are turned on by things and constantly, I think, adding pieces, hopefully. That's also done, again, with all of your help. And again, MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. I always appreciate all the contacts. It's difficult to reply to everything. But again, what I'm trying to say is we're not up here like, oh, me and Claude and James and Rich, oh, we've got it all figured out and we'll put it out for you. No. I doubt myself all the time about this. All of this. But media is what I know, and it is what I do, and I like to smash it all up and give it out to everybody. So let's get to our lead single story. And again, we posted this yesterday to MediaMonarchy.com, and as on so many levels, things moving so rapidly, again, as a one-man band, it's difficult to be a comprehensive source of things, especially when they're so quickly moving. But to put it on the record, let's give you the text that I have, and we will flesh it out with some multimedia. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, killed as the Western-backed liberation continues that we refer to. And as John Pilger notes, Africa's now open for plunder now that Libya has fallen. But from the Big Brother Corporation, Libya's ex-leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi has been killed after an assault on his birthplace of Sirte. The circumstances of his death are not yet clear. Video has emerged purporting to show Colonel Gaddafi being captured alive and bundled onto a truck. Fighters loyal to the National Transitional Council, NTC, said they found him hiding in a hole and shot him when he tried to escape. Gaddafi was toppled in August after 42 years in power. The NTC now plans to officially announce Libya's liberation before indicating the next steps toward democratic elections. After a day of conflicting reports and rumors, the NTC's acting Prime Minister Mahmoud Jibril told a news conference, quote, "We have been waiting for this moment for a long time. Muammar Gaddafi has been killed."
Breaking news, multiple media outlets reporting ousted Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi is captured and killed. Those outlets are displaying a graphic picture of Gaddafi bloodied and beaten. The Guardian quotes the UK Channel 4's Lindsay Hilsum as she tweeted the reaction in Tripoli. Great cries of Allah Akbar as TV shows picture what looks like a dead Gaddafi. People going crazy. Gaddafi's fall comes after a seven-month civil war led by a group called the National Transitional Council, a coalition of tribal and factional groups seeking to replace the 40-plus year dictator. Early this morning, the NTC launched its final assault on Gaddafi's stronghold of Sirte. CNN has that video.
There are still some small pockets of resistance that they're going around now trying to finally flush out the last remaining fighters. But essentially they have managed to push the front line right into District 2. We've been there all last week seeing how they've been pinned down under sniper fire, unable to get into that area. Now they have been able to get into that area. And it looks like now this is basically just going to be a sort of mopping up exercise.
CNN has the U.S. State Department's reaction to the news. The State Department can't confirm reports about the capture or killing of Muammar Gaddafi. NATO said its aircraft struck two pro-Gaddafi military vehicles in a Sirte vicinity on Thursday. Times Live reports on the reaction in Libya. Celebrations erupted in towns across Libya as news spread that the autocrat who ruled the country with an iron fist for 42 years was finally in custody. Again, multiple reports and pictures of the alleged killing of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi.
Bloomberg News has confirmed that Muammar Gaddafi is dead. That is the latest from the Misrata Military Council. Gaddafi died after being captured in his hometown of Sirte. We've got Bloomberg's Lara Satrakian live on the phone for us right now from Jordan with the latest. And Lara, tell me, what is the reaction, the repercussions from the news out now about Gaddafi being dead?
Well, Betty, this is the win the world was waiting for, especially here in the Middle East. Gaddafi spent more than four decades in power. He was a man who was dreaded, who was feared, and he had gone into hiding in Sirte, his hometown, that had been really the last stronghold for Libya, as we've been reporting. Especially this week, there had been this feeling that the revolution was 99% complete, but not totally done, and now it's over. And that's what everyone had been waiting for. The National Transitional Council that's been ruling the country effectively, certainly for the past few months, they have said all along that the real transition to democracy won't begin, the real country won't take shape until this happens. So this really is a stepping up of the revolution, of this regime change. Also a sense, Betty, that this is what it was going to take to get the economy back on its feet. There was still fighting around Sirte, especially heavy over the past few weeks. Now, in theory, it would subside. It gives them a better chance of pulling it all together, stabilizing the country, and really stepping up. The NTC's leadership also had been taking some criticism for just being fractional and just starting to break up, showing signs of division, that this might be what pulls them together.
And Lair, we have been showing live pictures all morning long about the celebration that is going on in his hometown of Sirte, as well as elsewhere in Libya, to the news of his death. I mean, where do we go from here in the Middle East, in Libya and in the Middle East?
In Libya, this starts, in theory, an eight-month countdown to democratic elections. There hasn't officially been a government in place. That transitional council was just a kind of caretaker. And again, they had taken criticism because so many of those officials had spent so long outside of the country. This is the chance for Libya to create something organic. People, at least here in the Middle East, feel optimistic. Tunisia holds its first free elections this weekend, a dramatic turning point, the first of its kind since the Arab Spring. And Egypt, there's a sense that the revolution is still in progress. I spoke to civil society activists this week. They say Egypt's revolution is hardly over. They're waiting to see what direction their country goes. So on top of that, of course, there's still unrest in Yemen, in Syria. Reports out of Bahrain that there's a sense that we're still really waiting to see how all of this pans out, but it is most certainly shaping all of these societies, Betty, and we're watching closely.
World leaders welcomed the news, urging the NTC to carry through on its promise to reform the country. UK Prime Minister David Cameron, who had been taking a leading role in NATO's intervention, said it was, quote, a day to remember all of Gaddafi's victims, as, of course, war criminal Blair gets to slip away. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called it an historic moment, but warned the road ahead for Libya and its people will be difficult and full of challenges. Proof of Gaddafi's fate came in grainy pieces of video first circulated among NTC fighters and then broadcast by international news channels. The first video showed a bloodied corpse looking like some type of death mask-wearing killer clown. The first video showed a bloodied corpse, with some channels picking up footage they said showed the colonel's body being dragged through the streets. An NTC fighter told the BBC he found Gaddafi hiding in a hall in Sirte, and the former leader begged him not to shoot. The fighter showed reporters a golden pistol he said he had taken from Gaddafi. Arabic TV channel showed images of troops surrounding two large drainage pipes where the reporter said Gaddafi was found. Later, another video emerged of the colonel being bundled onto the back of a pickup truck after being captured alive. NTC fighter said he was shot when he tried to escape. None of the video footage had been independently verified. Again, this being one of the earlier reports from the BBC that we have posted up with other related links to CBS News and the Washington Post. Our related geopolitical updates. U.S. USA. USA goes to Uganda. Obama opens the 8th war front and sends U.S. troops to Uganda. Meanwhile, Rush Limbaugh urges support for the African terrorist group. And if we take a quick blurb from allgov.com, Rush Limbaugh gained popularity for his provocative rants, but last Friday he went over the edge, defending a vicious African rebel group whose leader, Joseph Kony, has been charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity. The Lord's Resistance Army, a marauding, cult-like group in Central Africa, has been responsible for killing, wounding, and kidnapping tens of thousands of people, brainwashing young boys to become soldiers, and forcing young girls into sex slavery. In 2005, the International Criminal Court charged Kony with 12 counts of crimes against humanity and 21 counts of war crimes. But Limbaugh has a problem with the Obama administration sending U.S. troops after them, because they're Christians. The Lord's Resistance Army. Thank God we don't have brainwashed boys being soldiers and girls as sex slaves here. Whew. Amid BRICS rise and the Arab Spring, a new global order forms from the Christian Science Monitor, noting, of course, BRIC and the BRICS, rather, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. When a new world order was busy being born in 1989, and Beethoven's Ode to Joy played in a Berlin shorn of its Cold War wall, most of the world saw it as an epic and unforeseen liberation. The BRICS rise and the Arab Spring, and a new world order forms. So says the Christian Science Monitor. Telegraph reports U.S. troops massing on Afghanistan and Pakistan border, and Cryptagon gets into the State Department, shaking down a 23-year employee over their book on the Iraq, quote-unquote, reconstruction. We meant well. How I helped lose the battle for the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, by Peter Van Buren. More on the story from TomDispatch.com. And our last note is referenced in the clip that we heard as we get our geopolitical updates posted below this Gaddafi gone story. Tunisia elections roiled by dispute over the broadcast of an animated film called Persepolis. And we give you the link to our NavigatingNetflix.com Twitter feed at NavigateNetflix. It segues well as we go around the world as we look by way of the old gray lady, the New York Times. Mexico's president works to lock in the drug war. Calderon provokes dispute with the opposition party. As the twilight of his presidency sets in, President Felipe Calderon of Mexico is striving to lock in the militarized approach to drug cartels that has defined his tenure, pushing aside public doubts and pressing lawmakers to adopt strategies he hopes will outlast him. Mr. Calderon has recently stepped up calls for Mexico's Congress to approve stalled initiatives to remake state and local police forces, codify the military's role in fighting crime and broaden its powers, toughen the federal penal code, and tighten laws to stop money laundering. At this pivotal point, with violence swelling and presumptive candidates jockeying for position ahead of Mexico's presidential election in July 2012, Calderon has limited time to make the case that his strategy has worked. He insists that the country will eventually become more secure, although about 40,000 people have been killed since he declared his war against organized crime. He began waging that war shortly after taking office in 2006 as the violence climbed, and he has continued pressing his offensive against drug organizations as they've splintered and descended into bloody infighting over territory and criminal rackets. The inability to control the violence, with fresh horrors nearly every week. It's rattled even some admirers in the United States Congress, who have begun to question publicly whether Calderon's strategy, supported by the $1.4 billion in anti-crime aid the United States is providing through the multi-year Meridia Initiative, is making progress. Calderon's strategy is making progress. We add a lot of related subtextual links, more interviews and pieces from the New York Times, but also from Fox News Latino. And if you want to dive into this story and you have a strong stomach, BorderlandBeat.com is pretty much your source for the drug war gone wild in the North American Union. The related story we have posted at the very bottom of this Calderon works to lock in the drug war story. We'll try and have a positive drug story. Half of Americans support legal marijuana for the first time. A plurality of Americans for the first time supports the legalization of marijuana, according to a new Gallup survey. In the new poll, 50% said the use of marijuana should be made legal, while 46% opposed the idea. Last year, support for legalization was at 46%. And when you check out the link at Gallup.com, you can see the chart and you can see that now the two numbers have intersected. And a majority of Americans, at least according to this poll, have come to their senses and realized that a plant that grows on the earth, that was put here by your creator, whatever form that may take, is here for some reason. It wasn't genetically engineered in a lab by the eugenics-obsessed elite. But unfortunately, probably what is going to happen, they'll legalize it, but they will monopolize it, and they'll blow out the mom and pops, essentially, as we've already seen and we've already reported on, and we've reported on Obama's multiple lies about the drug war and ending it. They've only escalated it, just as he's escalated every other thing, as he's carried the nuclear and otherwise football from Bush. they're going to buy up the real, and they're going to give us the crap. The swag, if you will. Continuing with all our top stories on MediaMonarchy.com, hashtag Occupy Wall Street Movement marks its one-month anniversary. From publicbroadcasting.net and WAMC, and there is extra audio surrounding this out of Massachusetts, the Occupy Wall Street movement marked its one-month anniversary Monday, October 17th, as demonstrators spread to new places, but questions remain about whether the protest can turn into political action. The various protests under the Occupy Wall Street theme are not centrally organized, but are unified by the belief that too much power and wealth rests in the hands of just 1% of the population. The demonstrators have tied this to all matter of social ills, including the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the foreclosure crisis, and high unemployment. And we have our own formerly of Portland, Oregon, Tom Hartman, on the Occupy anniversary.
Happy anniversary, Occupy Wall Street. Today marks 1 month since people began camping out in Lower Manhattan to protest Wall Street's high crimes and disastrous influence on our economy. And in that month, this movement has transformed into an unstoppable force, occupying not just New York City, but the entire planet. Over the weekend, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets in Europe, South America, and Asia in solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street movement. In Rome, demonstrations turned violent as police cars in a government building were torched, causing over $1 million damage. Here in the United States, where protests have remained peaceful despite ongoing brutal police crackdowns, tens of thousands of people filled Times Square this weekend in New York City, and tens of thousands more occupied hundreds of cities across the country. And as we've seen each day, there were also mass arrests. 175 people arrested in Chicago for engaging in civil disobedience. 70 were arrested in New York City's Times Square. Nearly 100 people arrested in Arizona. A couple dozen more arrested in Denver. And here in the nation's capital, Princeton professor Cornel West joined nearly 20 other people in getting arrested in front of the Supreme Court as they were protesting the High Court's decision to hand our elections over to transnational corporations in last year's Citizens United case. Despite the arrests, the movement continues to grow and gain support, and perhaps more importantly, fundraise.
Now, before that clip, the blurb we were reading referenced the 1%. And that reminds me again, on the recent Ground Zero Media episode, Turn Me On, Dead Man, discusses again the numerology that we see. So that's the 1%, and we flip that over to look at the other side, and that's the 99%. Then we see Herman Cain's 999 tax plan. But I digress. Posted below this Occupy anniversary, we have our related EconoCrash updates, but first our related police state updates. As a State Department-funded agitator was in D.C. advising the Occupy Wall Street crowds, Wired Magazine and Threat Level reported Ahmed Mar of the infamous U.S.-funded Egyptian April 6th revolutionary movement that helped the U.S. topple Egypt's government in early 2011 is now back in D.C. advising Occupy Wall Street protesters face-to-face in McPherson Square. The article from Wired claims that protesters throughout the U.S. movement have cited, ironically, protest in Cairo as their inspiration to rise up against corruption in their government and financial institutions. While the Wired piece doesn't explain where Marr honed his revolutionary skills, it does mention vaguely that he was in D.C. on an invitation from an unnamed university professor, and that next he would be headed to New York City to advise protesters there. This, of course, isn't Marr's first trip to the United States. Years before the Egyptian Revolution, the United States was quietly preparing a global army of youth cannon fodder to fuel region-wide conflagrations throughout the world, both politically and literally. Marr's April 6 organization had been in New York City for the State Department's first Alliance for Youth Movement Summit in 2008. His group then headed to Serbia to train under the U.S.-funded Canvas organization before returning to Egypt in 2010 with U.S. International Crisis Group operative Mohammed El-Baradei to spend the next year building up for the Arab Spring. Considering the depth and planning and preparation by the U.S. State Department with the cooperation of other U.S. agencies, departments, and corporations, including the mainstream media, we can now see the full measure of collective duplicity throughout America's establishment. As many may remember, the United States acted with total surprise as the Arab Spring unfolded, despite having engineered it years in advance and having financial and tactical contacts with all the leading opposition groups. And if we hop to economicpolicyjournal.com, we will see that attacks on Ron Paul and libertarianism at large by Operation Wall Street insiders emails were leaked. You can look for them as the September 17 Google group. And Economic Policy Journal provides the links with search capability to these publicly leaked emails, exposing, of course, Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi and MSNBC's Dylan Radigan as providing the group with advice on how to deal with the media. And if you search Ron Paul, you will see, again, the marginalization by the co-opted, foundation-funded, limited hangout left gatekeepers. They're so genius explaining the financial collapse and the controlled demolition, but they just can't see it in the assassinations and black ops and all the other connected situations. Occupy Wall Street calls for global governance, and endoftheamericandream.com asking, is Operation Wall Street, or rather, I'm sorry, Occupy Wall Street, a communist movement run by socialists who wish to bring down the free enterprise system? We add the question mark and we add quotes around free enterprise. Poll shows majority of the original Occupy Wall Street and Zuccotti Park would vote for Obama again, and they approve of his job so far. Coming soon, Real World, Occupy Wall Street. Good job, Viacom and MTV, never missing an opportunity. Racial tensions at Occupy Philly. Again, I learned about this from groundzeromedia.org. They don't want you to hear the stories about essentially racial tensions and race riots, which connects right back to Charles Manson and the Piggies and Turn Me On Dead Man. And the IntelHub.com reports on Insider saying, and they are named, it goes on to discuss, and there's links to the Ulsterman report, where Bankster Elite Insider says, quote, something terrible is coming, so for now I'm getting out, end quote, of New York City. But why would you want to get out of New York City when we learned from the Columbia Broadcasting System that the Central Intelligence Officer holds a mysterious assignment at NYPD? So, yes, surprise, surprise, CIA officers are implanted within the NYPD. I am shocked. Government refuses FOIA request for secret interpretation of the Patriot Act. That's from Cryptogon, and so is DARPA hopes to sniff out who has fallen prey to dangerous ideas. And from our favorite threatiganda site, NationalTerrorAlert.com, TSA expanding their chat downs experiment to Detroit. And in Tennessee, they're so proud to become the first state to fight terrorism statewide. The Department of Safety and Homeland Security partners with federal, state agencies for safety statewide operation.
Tennessee is now the first state ever to work with the TSA to deploy a simultaneous counterterrorism operation statewide. News Channel 5's Adam Gassimi was at one of their weigh station checkpoints today near Portland.
Yeah, Vicki, you know, this was a massive operation, really bringing all federal, state, and local agencies together to not only do random searches, but also create an army of agents on wheel. You're probably used to seeing these signature blue uniforms at the airport. But now TSA agents are on the interstates fighting terrorism with visible intermodal prevention and response, or VIPR, operations.
Where is a terrorist most apt to be found? Not these days on an airplane, more likely on the interstate.
Tuesday, Tennessee was the first to do this simultaneously at 5 way stations and 2 bus stations statewide.
They're recruiting truck drivers like Rudy Gonzalez into the First Observer Highway Security Program to say something if they see something.
Not only truck drivers, but cars, everybody should be aware of what's going on the road.
It's all meant to urge every driver to call authorities if they see something suspicious.
If somebody sees something somewhere, and we want them to be responsible citizens, report that, and let us work it through our processes to vet the concern that they had when they saw something suspicious.
The Tennessee Highway Patrol is checking trucks with drug and bomb-sniffing dogs during random inspections. During one today, they found barrels of chemicals on the back of this truck that seemed suspicious. But after checking for dangerous levels of combustibles,
it's all clear. Good news.
The driver had to only secure a loose barrel before getting back on the road with countless other tractor trailers. Homeland Security officials worry one day could be used for terrorism.
The bottom line is this: if you see something suspicious, say something about it.
Now, the random inspections really aren't any more thorough than normal, but Colonel Tracy Trott with the Tennessee Highway Patrol says it's all in the details, pointing out what happened when an Oklahoma State trooper stopped Timothy McVeigh for not having a license plate just after the Oklahoma City bombing. Vicki?
Adam, thanks. We want to urge you, today's Viper searches did not come from any particular threat. One TSA official says intelligence tells them they should be focusing on the highways as well as the airports.
Oh, of course. Where are terrorists most likely to be found? They're going to be found in positions of power so they can abuse that power to indulge their proclivities. Our last police state update note, we probably would have covered this on New World Next Week had it broken before we shot it, but from the BBC asking the question, is the U.S. Declaration of Independence illegal? Let's leave that question to get to another one that starts off our related EconoCrash updates, again posted below the Operation Wall Street anniversary. Does one super corporation run the global economy? This story from the Daily Mail gets into a study, claims it could be terrifyingly unstable. Research finds that 147 companies formed a super entity within the group, controlling 40% of its wealth. And there is a chart that shows 1,318 transnational corporations that form the core of the globalized economy. It's impressive looking at first, but it pales in comparison to, I think, the work of someone like Mark Lombardi and their global networks. The coming derivatives crisis that could destroy that super corporation-run global financial system. More on that from the economiccollapseblog.com. The new reality for cities: no money for streetlights, roving packs of wild dogs, and open-air drug markets. Coming soon to a blown-out husk of a city near you. Meanwhile, the U.S. Misery Index rises to its highest level since 1983. Pennsylvania School District allows advertising in public schools and on their buses. More on that from AllGov. Unpaid student loans top $1 trillion. The story comes from the USA Today, but we'll read a quick blurb again from the indispensable Cryptogon.com. This whole student loan apocalypse is another confetti currency bubble scam. There are many parallels to the housing bubble, except, of course, that people can't live inside those useless degrees obtained with borrowed money that can never be repaid. The availability of the loans is driving the ludicrous tuition increases, just like the funny money mortgages inflated the real estate market. And the Federal Reserve Bank of New York reports unpaid student loans top $1 trillion. Its official first-class stamp will cost 45 cents coming this January. Again, to the EconoCrash United States. TSA spent $56.8 billion to keep it safe. FastCompany.com asks if it works. And according to them, oh, it's all fantastic. Money well spent. Our last couple of EconoCrash notes that, again, it's all connected. It all swirls around. There are so many times that these stories and headlines could fall under different headings, but it's ultimately in the way that I put the show together that it flows, that we do this. Napolitano says DHS authorizing illegals to work in the U.S. That's from CNSNews.com. And finally, from USA Today, Mexican trucks due to begin going deep into U.S. But there is no NAFTA superhighway. There is no plan to harmonize the trade laws within North America. There was no security and prosperity partnership. Bush and Harper and Fox and now Obama and all the rest of them, they don't meet to discuss the integration of the three nations. But there it is. We've made it, my friends, now to the 1020 News Purge on MediaMonarchy.com. It's an ugly list of headlines, and we call it Everybody's Talking About the Stormy Weather, which is the quote from Sonic Youth's Teenage Riot that opened this show. And we'll begin with our BioWars and EnviroHealth updates. Just hours before the real thing in East Bay, California, millions participated in a statewide earthquake drill. Two earthquakes yesterday off the coast of California. Second earthquake, jolts Bay Area. Both our links go to mercurynews.com. Series of earthquakes strike the Big Island of Hawaii. That's from the Boston Globe. And Victoria Advocate reports about earthquake shakes South Texas. But that's all right. The Los Angeles Times is reporting U.S. and Mexico to install quake sensors in two border city areas. Vaccine News Daily reporting Palm Beach, Florida confirms the first ever dengue fever case. And as things get stranger, and as it is a war in inner space and outer space, as we will see, it is a psychological, it is a war on your consciousness, but there are very bizarre things in the physical world, such as the albino cyclops shark.
What was once fishy fiction might now be fact. Researchers say that the albino cyclops shark is the real deal, and the media is sinking its teeth into this story. KXTV explains.
Sharks, they're scary enough, right? But imagine a shark with just one eye.
They call it a cyclops shark.
Oh, and look at that.
And this,
that's not real.
No, it hasn't been photoshopped. It is scary. It's very rare. And yes, it is real. It almost looks smiley there.
It reminds me of Finding Nemo.
Pisces Fleet Sport Fishing discovered the mutant fetus earlier this summer when they cut open the belly of a pregnant dusky shark from the Gulf of California. The company posted this picture on its website, and it was met with some hearty skepticism. A manager for the company tells the New York Daily News, people did not believe us. You wouldn't believe the comments we got, like, a Cabbage Patch doll is missing an eye. But now, about 4 months later, researchers say the cyclops shark is legit. The Daily News reports one shark expert is on the verge of releasing a scientific paper claiming the find is a rare case of cyclopia. Cyclopia is a real anomaly in which only one eye develops, and we've seen it before in humans and animals. National Geographic reports, cyclops sharks have been documented by scientists a few times before, also as embryos, and the fact that none have been caught outside the womb suggests cyclops sharks don't survive long in the wild. But many are still skeptical. Could this be a Photoshop prank? A blogger for The Stir shares her disbelief, saying, we've got a right to be nervous about accepting this photographic evidence, since recently a lot of us, including major news networks, were duped into thinking a shark was swimming in the flooded streets of Puerto Rico after Hurricane Irene blew through. And a writer for the Herald Sun jokes, the first question that comes to mind, are fishermen that good at Photoshop? The second, why isn't it shooting lasers from its eye? Despite all the doubt, multiple calls, including one from Ripley's Believe It or Not, have been made to buy, rent, or borrow the carcass. But sorry, the fishermen say it's not for sale.
As we end our BioWars EnviroHealth updates on a cryptozoological note, it makes for a bizarre transition into our couple of history mystery updates as we're blasting through the 1020 News Purge. The dynasts of the Daily Press, the Magnificent Medills, America's royal family of journalism during a century of turbulent splendor. In place of the press lords, the United States had press families. The Binghams in Louisville, the Chandlers in Los Angeles, the Oaks, Sulzbergers in New York and Chattanooga. None, though, compared in power or zaniness with the family of Joseph Medill at its height. Born in 1823, Medill was a fervent abolitionist, one of the founders of the Republican Party, and is perhaps most notable for having helped put Abraham Lincoln over as his party's candidate in the 1860 presidential election. In 1855, Medill bought a one-third ownership of the Chicago Daily Tribune and eventually controlled the majority stock in the paper, which he took great care before his death in 1899 to make certain stayed in the family. I had never heard of the Medill family. M-E-D-I-L-L-S, and this book, The Magnificent Medills, is by Megan McKinney, and that dynast of the Daily Press is in the New York Times Book Review. Historic Seattle's Uptown Theater is back and better than ever. Press release on MarketWatch.com. And from Newsday, another anniversary note, October 20th, yesterday, 1977, 34 years ago, Lynyrd Skynyrd's plane crashes. That takes us directly into our media memes updates. As we started the show with some of the greatest from Sonic Youth, Teenage Riot, and it was good. And now we hit the media memes, and it's bad. Sonic Youth's Kim Gordon and Thurston Moore split after 27 years of marriage. The group's future is uncertain after their current tour, and we've got stories from PrefixMag.com and the Marquee blog on CNN discussing this sad development. I probably mentioned on this show I've seen Sonic Youth several times and am a big fan. And this is one of those... It's sad, you know. I saw it said, it was like, oh, first R.E.M. and now Kim and Thurston breaking up. They're pretty much the grandfathers, if you will, of what is now alternative rock, having formed in the early 80s. Been around that long. So we began our show with a track that, if you've ever listened to Sonic Youth, you probably heard Teenage Riot. Let's take a moment now to listen to one that you maybe never heard, and it's probably them at their goofy best. They didn't call themselves Sonic Youth. They called themselves Ciccone Youth when they got into the groovy.
Just let go, you sit.
Chicone Youth, a.k.a. Sonic Youth, Into the Groovy, put out on the Whitey album that apparently was stopped from being litigated against by Madonna's record label by the Material Girl herself. So as long as we're discussing her, we'll grab a quick one from the Nonprofit Quarterly. As we note, the IRS is investigating the Kabbalah Center. Madonna, Roseanne, and other celebrity supporters remain quiet. But we're into hour number two of episode 236 from MediaMonarchy.com. It's October 21st, 2011, Rapture Day, my friends, and we are halfway through the 1020 news purge. Everybody's talking about the stormy weather as we continue our media memes as the morgue turns Lindsay Lohan away for being 40 minutes late to her community service at the L.A. morgue. Discussed in one of the recent Ground Zero behind-the-scenes videos on Ground Zero TV, the clown makeup, the corpse mask, and again, the sinister forces that we see playing out on the pop culture stage right in front of us. From Lars von Trier's End Times film to caustic visions from Polanski, Cronenberg, and Almodovar, this year is the New York Film Festival's Year of the Apocalypse. More on that from Twitter at Navigate Netflix. Edgar M. Vilcher, hi-fi innovator, dies at the age of 94. More on that from the New York Times. And we'll close out our media memes, which will segue nicely into our murder and mayhem updates, with a story that is a couple of weeks old and was something that I tweeted about at the time, but I realized as the week or two or three went by that we never covered it on the show, and I thought it was quite worth mentioning. And that would go back to September 29th, and we'll grab it from Media Decoder. The United States Capitol Police said they were investigating The Onion, a satirical media organization, for making false reports on Twitter claiming that there was a hostage situation inside the Capitol building.
Members of Congress can often be the butt of tasteless jokes here in Washington, but today the publication known as The Onion is in serious hot water for posting a horrifying story that many say went over the line. CNN's Athena Jones joins us now with details. Athena.
Joe, as you mentioned, The Onion is a satirical newspaper, and usually their stories poking fun at members of Congress, at the White House, and at ordinary folks prompt a lot of laughs, but today was a different story.
Just one day after a Massachusetts man was arrested for allegedly plotting to use model airplanes to attack the Capitol, a fake news story by The Onion about members of Congress holding children at gunpoint was not welcome. The trouble began Thursday morning when the satirical newspaper tweeted, "Breaking: witnesses reporting screams and gunfire heard inside Capitol building." A short time later came this tweet, "Breaking: Capitol building being evacuated. 12 children held hostage by group of armed congressmen."
They were posting tweets on their own without any context, and you can understand why some people may have been freaked out temporarily by that.
20 minutes after the first tweet, The Onion linked to this story, "Congress takes group of school children hostage," which included an obviously doctored photo of Speaker John Boehner and a short video purported to have been shot during the standoff, with people impersonating a senator and congressman. The reaction was swift, leading the Capitol Police to release a statement after multiple calls from the press, saying in part, "It has come to our attention that recent Twitter feeds are reporting false information concerning current conditions at the U.S. Capitol. Conditions at the U.S. Capitol are currently normal. There is no credibility to these stories or the Twitter feeds." Despite the confusion and anger the fake story prompted, media watchers say even jokes people don't like must be protected.
Yelling fire in a crowded virtual theater is not the same as yelling fire in an actual theater. And in this case, humor has to be protected.
Now, Joe, none of the offices of the members who were mentioned in the story or in that short video had any comment on the record, but the staffers I spoke with said that they believed this Onion joke was an incredibly poor taste. Now, for the Onion's part, earlier today they were quoted as saying, this is satire, this is how it works. When I spoke with them and asked them if they were sorry that the story was taken the wrong way, I didn't get much of a comment back until just a little while ago when they sent this statement. I'll read a part of it. They said, we at the Onion feel it would be irresponsible to comment on such irresponsible reporting, nor will we succumb to unfounded sensationalism until all the facts have been thoroughly obscured. So just another sign that the Onion wants to keep this joke going, Joe.
Thank you so much for that reporting, Athena.
Thanks.
Ah, I'm glad we put that on the record, and all those original tweets are still there, and we provide links to our retweet from Boston.com on the original day, on September 29th. But if you dig back, I can't really find that original video, and that's the way I saw it. I subscribe to the Onion News video feed, so I get them in my podcatcher. And I remember seeing the video, and it was super short. So when I was trying to put together this clip, I couldn't find that clip anywhere. The hostage video, ostensibly taken with a cell phone camera, that video seems to have been scrubbed. But, my friends, as I tell you, and haven't maybe told you in a while, I save everything. I archive everything. The HTMLs, all the audio, all the videos, all those things I save and I archive. Not only what I cover on my show, but all the things that I subscribe to in podcasts. And I burn those off on hard disks and stack them up. So when I couldn't find this Onion Congress hostage video, I just went back to my September 2011 archive disk and pulled it off and got it for you. So again, we weren't able to find it, but let's check it out one more time.
Nobody move, you're all gonna die.
Hey, Boehner, this kid's got a phone.
So that was the original 10-second video. Which, as I said, folks, segues quite nicely to our Murder and Mayhem updates, which seem to grow larger and stranger as the weeks go by. Wild exotic animals escape farm as the owner is found dead. The original story from the Los Angeles Times, but we have other bits from Twitter, from the Sydney Morning Herald, like Noah's Ark wrecking. Exotic animals free run ends in tragedy. And again, these are the kind of stories that we see play out on the national, international scene that seem to suggest sinister forces, seem to suggest some other type of operation that we see in front of us. Indy 500 champion Dan Weldon dies in a 15-car Indy car crash at the age of 33, but drivers had safety concerns about the racetrack beforehand. Both those from CBS News. At Navigate Netflix, thieves inspired by the movie The Town use bleach to cover up their DNA and their crimes. Amish renegades accused in bizarre haircutting attacks on their Ohio peers. That story from the New York Times. Five foreign nationals in custody after attempted break-in at Texas courthouse. Man on Southwest flight allegedly tries to break into the cockpit. Seattle superhero dodges assault charges. And Detroit's real-life Batman must hang up his tights. Predictive programming, art imitating life, imitating politics. It's kick-ass come to life. So as we see self-styled superheroes in Seattle and Detroit, if we look at China, people ignore a dying child run over by two different vehicles, and there is unfortunate video from Cryptogon.com. But the last note on Murder and Mayhem, U.S. leads the developed world in child abuse death rates. Our Obamasiah updates, and again, my friends, it's a seamless tapestry. Vice President Joe Biden evokes violent sexual imagery again in his latest jobs bill push. More on that from Fox. A lorry with Obama's lectern and teleprompter stolen in Richmond, Virginia, but they were recovered. More on that from the Deutsche Press Agency. What would President Teleprompter do without his teleprompter? corporate-funded think tanks host GOP debate. They are, of course, seeking the best representative for their corporate sponsors. And a great question, did Herman Cain base his 999 tax plan on SimCity 4, which came out years before, which has the exact same tax plan? Friends, I hope you noticed that we reported on the 999 tax plan before it became part of the larger story. And again, as we see, the stories discussed on groundzeromedia.org become the news later. The 999 tax plan. We are the 99%. 9 in numerology, an ending number. That's why it always goes to 0 after that, except you add a 1, or a 2, or a 3. Our final Obamasiah and all the other related jockeying will end with a Ron Paul update as his plan balances the budget in 3 years.
GOP presidential candidate Ron Paul says he can fix the federal budget blues, and he can do it in 3 years. It's a plan being hailed in the media as bold, whether for better or for worse. HLN has the details.
GOP presidential hopeful Ron Paul says that he would slash $1 trillion from the federal budget, and that's just in his first year in office. Paul says that he would wipe out the Departments of Energy, Housing and Urban Development, Commerce, Interior, Education, and the TSA. He also says he would end all foreign wars.
The Libertarian congressman also says he'd trim the president's annual salary to the average American salary, about $39,000. Overall, the federal workforce would be cut by 10%. But CNN's Gloria Borger points out, while Paul's scissors may be sharp, some big budget items appear to have been spared.
Once you look at the details, people are going to start raising questions about it. One other thing, he doesn't touch Social Security or, guess what, Medicare. And those, even to this libertarian, seem to be sort of sacred cows, wouldn't you say, in an election year?
Even without touching Social Security and Medicare, a blogger for the conservative American Thinker says big and bold is just what the GOP needs, saying voters want one conservative candidate with the guts to proclaim that the federal government needs more than handyman work. It needs an overhaul. So far, the plan hasn't generated as much media buzz as Herman Cain's 999 plan. In fact, a new study shows Paul has had a hard time grabbing headlines in general. That study out of the Pew Research Center found out of all the major candidates, Paul has received the least amount of news coverage. A blogger for NPR says this bold budget plan may change that, but attention comes with a price tag. While Paul is likely to get a fresh blast of attention from many Republican voters intrigued by what is indisputably a bold idea, he's also likely to face serious criticisms, too. Fox News' Neil Cavuto explored one of those serious criticisms, major cuts to the FDA, with an analyst on a show. That analyst says Paul has some questions to answer, but at least he's putting ideas out there.
You put a proposal out there like this, a very bold proposal, you've got to be able to take the criticism. One good thing about this plan, it's going to force his other competitors out there for this presidential primary to come out with a plan to not just talk about cutting waste, fraud, and abuse, but to actually have some strong, bold proposals.
As we reach the bottom of the 1020 news purge, everybody's talking about the stormy weather. We reach West Virginia worry. As some of you may know, I've been in Oregon for about 6 years now, but I'm born and raised west, by God, Virginia. Forgetting his own family background, Senator Jay Rockefeller calls Gaddafi a cruel and violent tyrant. More on that from WVMetroNews.com. And the first of a few police brutality notes that we get by way of the indispensable InjusticeEverywhere.com. Excessive force allegations against three officers in Harrison County.
Harrison County Prosecuting Attorney's Office is looking into allegations that three police officers used excessive force against a man Thursday morning. Jordy Humphrey Jr. filed a complaint that he was beaten early Thursday morning on Buchanan Pike in Nutter Court by two sheriff's deputies and a Nutter Court police officer. He says he was stopped around 2 in the morning for having a loud muffler. He claims he was questioned about having a formerly suspended license, but Humphrey said nothing is suspended now and everything came back up to date when the officers checked. He says that's when officers asked him why he looked suspicious and asked him to step out of the car. When he got out, he tried to run behind the Mountaineer Mart where he says he was tackled, handcuffed, and beat. Humphrey claims he was also beaten in an incident with another officer last year, an incident that motivated him to run this time around. What you're about to hear is his account of what happened.
I decided to try to run to get away. They chased me and tackled me. You know, if they would just tackle me and cuff me and put me in the car, that would have been fine. But to beat me like this, that's not right. You know, something's got to be done. Somebody's going to die around here.
He has 7 broken bones in his face, popped ribs, and a torn eyelid that is stitched shut. Schaefer says Pumphrey is charged with 1 count of fleeing on foot, 3 counts of battery against a police officer, and 1 count of obstruction. Sheriff Albert Miranda says both his deputies have been placed on administrative duties, and his office is also doing an internal investigation. He can't comment on the situation since the investigation is ongoing. Calls to the Nutter Fort Police Department have not yet been returned.
And second, Berkeley Springs, Morgan County man shot by the police, files a federal lawsuit. And third, Parkersburg police sergeant placed on leave pending investigation.
A Parkersburg police officer is on paid administrative leave after an altercation with a suspect at the Wood County holding facility. The details top our news tonight at 6. Mayor Robert Newell says that Sergeant J. A. Vinsel was placed on leave and will remain there until an internal investigation of the incident is finished. The alleged incident took place Saturday night as the other party, suspect Jerry Seabolt, was being processed into the holiday facility located on 2nd Street. Police Chief Joe Martin says he has viewed a video of the alleged incident and added that the incident was not included in Sergeant Vinsel's Saturday night report, as it should have been. Prosecutor Jason Wharton says he contacted the superintendent of the West Virginia State Police to ask that a state policeman from outside the area do an internal investigation of the incident. Newell says Seabolt was taken to a Parkersburg hospital after the alleged incident, but was not admitted and was returned to the holding facility. According to the Wood County Magistrate's Office, Seabolt had been arrested by Parkersburg police on charges of battery and public intoxication and is now also facing a charge of obstruction. He's out on bond and will appear in Wood County Magistrate Court at a later date.
Now, I believe that's our third straight week of bad news about the Parkersburg police in West Virginia. And I'm reminded, sidebar, our own mayor here in Portland, Oregon, Sam Adams, is apparently going to China for 10 days. So he's not going to be around for any of the latest developments with hashtag Occupy Portland. But that's just a sidebar as we're continuing and closing out our West Virginia worry updates. Basketball legend and native West Virginian Jerry West reveals childhood beatings on an HBO special. And we close out West Virginia worry and we close out the 1020 news purge. Everybody's talking about the stormy weather with a piece from WVRecord.com as a third lawsuit filed against the All Good Music Festival. Dateline Clarksburg, West Virginia, a third lawsuit has been filed in federal court against the All Good Music Festival, its owners, organizers, hosts, and traffic and security providers for the event. Elizabeth Rose Doran, a friend of the South Carolina woman killed at this year's festival, filed her own lawsuit on October 11th in U.S. District Court for the Northern District of West Virginia. The defendants named include pretty much everybody. And I recall reading a story in The Stranger, perhaps, or the Seattle Weekly, about the nitrous mafia around the country with nitrous oxide in balloons at concerts. And the All Good Festival in Masontown in Preston County, West Virginia, was one of the main hubs that they covered in this piece. That's the end of West Virginia worry. That's the end of the news purge. That's the end of all our stories from MediaMonarchy.com as we now move to the other sites under the banner within the Media Monarchy Kingdom. And we go to CyberspaceWar.com first as Xnihilator celebrates 1 year of posting on CyberspaceWar.com. You may know I refer to him as Alan in Omaha. But a huge thanks to him and all the hard work he does on not only now Cyberspace War, but he's also writing for HolyHexes.com. And as we were kind of chatting behind the scenes, as we try and build our little meager info warriors together to help flesh this out, sometimes it's too much work. But a huge thanks to Alan, and I appreciate it. Blasting through CyberspaceWar.com, and isn't it interesting, this story came out just days before the latest death abroad from a hole, dying like a dog, like something from Kafka. U.S. weighed use of cyber attacks to weaken Libya from the New York Times. Just before the American-led strikes against Libya in March, the Obama administration intensely debated whether to open the mission with a new kind of warfare, a cyber offensive to disrupt and even disable the Gaddafi government's air defense system, which threatened Allied warplanes. While the exact techniques under consideration remain classified, the goal would have been to break through the firewalls of the Libyan government's computer networks to sever military communications links and prevent the early warning radars from gathering information and relaying it to missile batteries aiming at NATO warplanes. But administration officials and even some military officials balked, fearing that it might set a precedent for other nations, in particular Russia or China, to carry out such offenses of their own and questioning whether the attack could be mounted on such short notice. They were also unable to resolve whether the president had the power to proceed with such an attack without informing Congress. In the end, American officials rejected cyber warfare and used conventional aircraft, cruise missiles, and drones to strike the Libyan air defense missiles and radars used by Colonel Muammar al-Gaddafi's government. More on this story from the New York Times and Russia Today and Threat Level and the French Agency Press and the Washington Post, letting you in on the idea. Oh, we were going to do it, but we haven't. Wink, wink. And the story we cover on episode 88 of NewWorldNextWeek.com, Supreme Court of Canada rules internet links not libel. Big victory for internet freedom. And let's blast through the 1020 DEFCON news purge on cyberspacewar.com, ops, apps, and agony. And we discussed it earlier on our Operation Occupy coverage, but here it is again from Danger Room, top Egypt Facebook revolutionary advising Operation Wall Street. Anti-cheating boyfriend app, forced to change. And I think this is unrelated from the story that then came out about using Find a Friend, Find Your Friends, whatever app, discovering cheating spouses. Another piece from the New York Times that I saw as I was reading in the break room, eating a salad. It is a theater review for a one-man show called The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. And this clip from PBS will help flesh out the moral issues behind the iPhone god and its makers.
Now, the very serious side that this piece takes is when you go, and I mentioned espionage, you sort of go undercover here to China, to the town, the city, right?
Yes.
Of Shenzhen, to a major factory where a lot of these gadgets are made.
Yeah.
And you find things that, as you tell us, underage workers, people working extensively long hours in bad conditions.
Yeah. And I like to think I'm not naive. I expect the conditions to be hard. I think we all have a feeling. We don't know the details, but we know it's not good in China. But I didn't expect the widespread, almost casual dehumanization, the amount of really almost callow brutality. That's not necessary. We're just simple humane rules about how long a worker can work. You know, while I was there, and a worker at Foxconn, a subsidiary that makes Apple products, died after working a 32-hour shift. And that's not unusual. That actually happens all the time. And I observed and watched these things and then bring the stories back after interviewing, you know, hundreds of workers and talking to them about what goes on.
The argument in China for years has been that the creation of these factories, these plants, is allowing a generation of people to get more, to get work, to get more money, to build up to a more of a middle class existence, right?
Right.
What the argument at Apple is that they have said their factories of this sort are done under watchful eyes, right? Have they?
Well, they would say that, but even their own internal reports, which are not answerable to anyone or audited by anyone, report widespread problems. That year after year, every year, their supplier responsibility report is filled with 30, 40, 50% of their contractors using child labor. And every year they say, well, we're going to try harder. I mean, it's not, there's no serious effort. And that's because we don't see those workers as human beings. We don't really understand what's going on because we refuse to put our hands in it and actually get involved.
The agony and the ecstasy of Steve Jobs. The one-man show, a monologue, and the moral issues behind iPhone and its makers. And that is, unfortunately, my friends, some of the crappy, complicit compromises I have to make to live somewhat the way you want to live. And a MacBook helps me bring you this show each and every week and every post you see in the Media Monarchy Kingdom. Was the 1883 Astro Mystery a near-miss billion-ton comet? Wired UK asking that question, and MSNBC asking this singularity question: does the future hold avatar-like bodies for us? And finally, from the Moscow Times and Red Orbit, interestingly enough, Russians want to build colony on the moon, and they also back a United Nations-controlled space shield to protect said Earth. Continuing through cyberspacewar.com, Galileo satellites provide more global security. A pair of Italian-built Galileo GPS satellites launched from French Guiana, giant Russian Antonov 124 cargo plane delivered the satellites last month. More from spaceflightnow.com and the Galileo satellite systems and its security implications. Don't worry about those connections to the Rand Corporation or the World Bank. Life in the Outer Solar System. A Universe Today article, A Tale of Three Moons, Is There Life in the Outer Solar System? More from the Europa Exobiology page and Space.com article, Antarctic Diving Robot Practices for Europa Mission. That would be the Jovian Moon. Microbes from Outer Space. Everyone learns in school outer space is a near total vacuum, a lifeless void. Scientists suggest otherwise in the Daily Galaxy article, Microbes Found Pre-Adapted for Life in Space. Scientists surmise microorganisms on Earth could only have received radiation-resistant genes from space-voyaging ancestors. Research reveals microbes mixed with a little sandstone can survive space at least for a few years. It's also estimated bacteria are capable of surviving with only the protection of a rock in space for a million years. Which constantly reminds me of some type of biological space germ. A contagion, an Andromeda strain, allegedly, in the predictive programming. Multiple UFO sightings in March 1966 in southeast Michigan provide a classic episode when J. Allen Hynek dismissed the sightings as swamp gas in the marshlands outside Ann Arbor. You can get the old original story, relive the mid-60s pop culture with a Walter Cronkite narrated CBS report in short version or in the longer version on the documentary on CNET, UFO Friend, Foe, or Fantasy. Our final cyberspacewar.com note comes from thehackernews.com, National Cybersecurity Bulletin on Anonymous. DHS has analyzed the likelihood of Anonymous attacking industrial control systems after the hacktivist groups showed such intentions earlier this year. Assessment of Anonymous threat to control system, with the PDF link for you, drafted by the National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration System, NCCIC, back in September. The document is not classified, but it is intended for official use only. The report describes an interest within Anonymous to target industrial control systems. More from thetechherald.com and the Wikipedia link to learn and read about industrial control systems. And again, ask the question, who is Anonymous? I was reminded, again, so many things to swirl around. It seems like every other day I'll go, oh God, that's right, that story, that's coming up. Like the National Emergency Broadcast Test coming up on 11-9. Or November 5th. Remember the 5th of November, the day Anonymous claims they will destroy Facebook. But let's move to foodworldorder.com for the 1020 binge and purge, co-ops, bailouts, and the gateway bug. CivilEats.com getting into hashtag Occupy Wall Street and the food movement. And the Vancouver Sun asks the question, are co-ops the solution to Occupy Wall Street woes? So that comes from Vancouver, out of British Columbia. I know we have other discussions, I believe, coming from TragedyAndHope.com concerning the food movement. And we need to make some contact there and get something happening on FoodWorldOrder.com. And again, it's my bad for not reaching out more and setting up more interviews. But we should also talk to our man Paul Verge of Divergent Films on BC and the food movement. But I digress yet again. Obama administration bailed out the GM salmon firm Aqua Bounty. More on that from The Guardian. And OrganicConsumers.org prints an email from Seventh Generation responding to a consumer question about GMOs, where they ultimately say yes, in some of these things there are genetically modified organisms. Anthony Bourdain's vegetarian hate speech interview with Playboy, angrily mentioned by VegetarianStar.com. And we close out this 1020 Binge and Purge co-ops bailouts with the gateway bug, moth larva tacos. That's what Grist.org calls it. And I call it more insects as food programming, as we have seen, as we covered, if not last week, the week before. Six-legged steak, or whatever we called it. I heard people at work, I overheard people saying, oh yeah, bugs, oh yeah, kids will eat, you know, it'll be, essentially they were saying it'll be okay to transition our children into eating bugs because they've been trained with this post 9/11 eugenics obsessed New World Order ever since they've been born. I guess this is related. UK man lives off roadkill for 30 years. British taxidermist specialty is pan-fried crane flies. From KPRC, a British conservationist claims he's lived off roadkill for 30 years, cooking up owl curries and rat stir fries, to make use of meat that otherwise goes to waste. Jonathan McGowan, 44-year-old professional taxidermist, began his foray into roadkill cuisine at the age of 14 when he cooked a dead snake he found on the side of the road. More on this story from, of course, the Daily Mail. State Department says biotech labeling would scare the consumers. A Council on Foreign Relations member speaks to other, again, multi-generational serial-killing, eugenics-obsessed elite biotech giants, in this case. From the Des Moines Register, the Obama administration shows no sign of changing the government's position on labeling of biotech foods, despite a renewed effort by consumer advocacy groups and environmental organizations to require manufacturers to disclose the use of genetically engineered ingredients. Jose Fernandez, the State Department's Assistant Secretary for Economic, Energy, and Business Affairs, said that such labeling would scare consumers away from those foods. Quote, if you label something, there's an implication there's something wrong with it, end quote, said Fernandez, speaking on a panel organized by CropLife International, a group that represents Monsanto, DuPont, and other biotech giants. The State Department has been working along with the Department of Agriculture to encourage foreign countries to permit the production and use of biotech crops. And we give you the link to read more about CropLife, and we give you the link to read more about Council on Foreign Relations member Jose Fernandez. Reasons why buying in bulk is smart, economical, and eco-friendly, from Eco Salon, with more from National Public Radio and linking to bulkisgreen.org as it's National Bulk Foods Week, October 16th through the 22nd. This is another story from ecosalon.com. You may recall we go over interesting uses for vinegar and baking soda recently. Attention surrounds foie gras as California ban looms, and the group says widespread public support for the ban on foie gras, from APRL, with a press release on MarketWatch. As seen in the New York Times, with a link for you, the Animal Protection and Rescue League protested a foie gras dinner held to call attention to a statewide ban on force feeding and sale of products of force feeding, the group helped pass, which takes effect next year. Foie gras, that's F-O-I-E-G-R-A-S, is the grossly enlarged liver of a force-fed duck. So foie gras basically means fat liver, like Mardi Gras means Fat Tuesday. Our extensive research has only uncovered about 300 restaurants in California to have ever been serving foie gras, states APRL campaigns director Jonathan Wadley, Ph.D. Of those, we have already convinced over 100 to move it. Last month, the Los Angeles City Council unanimously passed a resolution applauding the animal protection measure and commending restaurants for removing the controversial item before the ban takes effect. Six other city councils, San Fran, San Diego, Berkeley, Solana Beach, West Hollywood, and Carlsbad, have also done the same. And we did get one comment from HumaneSociety.org on foie gras. Discounts for Walgreens customers who get the flu shot vaccine from naturalnews.com. Did you see the reports about Walgreens customers feeling verbally harassed by Walgreens employees at the checkout counter over flu shots? Multiple accounts from naturalnews.com readers have continued to describe aggressive verbal harassment by Walgreens employees who appear to be over the top in pushing flu shots. And there is a Walgreens at the end of the block from where I work. And they have their signs all over the place. They've got them out front. They make their employees wear shirts that say, "Have you gotten your shot?" And I think Safeway and a ton of other stores are doing it. But we end foodworldorder.com with another one from civileats.com. PepsiCo wants to scare the crap out of your kids. PepsiCo has long been poster child for food corporations whose actions speak louder than words when it comes to responsible marketing. CEO Indra Nooyi loves to tout the company's performance with purpose and show off the company's good-for-you foods that it gets to define. Most don't realize that PepsiCo is the nation's largest food company, with five divisions spanning from soda to salty snacks to breakfast cereals. With annual revenues of $60 billion and 285,000 employees, PepsiCo is an multinational corporate behemoth. But now the company's true colors, again, being revealed in all their twisted marketing glory. A legal complaint with the PDF link for you, as always, my friends, filed with the FTC by the Center for Digital Democracy and several other groups, called upon the agency to investigate PepsiCo and its subsidiary Frito-Lay for, quote, engaging in deceptive and unfair digital marketing practices, end quote, in violation of federal law. Even if you thought you already knew that teenagers were being targeted online by junk food brands, I can guarantee that the marketing strategies revealed in this complaint and accompanying report, with another PDF link for you, will freak you out, either as a parent or just as a human being. Among the clever techniques PepsiCo has deployed are horror video games called Hotel 626 and its even scarier successor, Asylum 626, which the company's ad agency, Goodby Silverstein and Partners, explained were designed to, quote, scare the crap out of teenagers, end quote, in the hopes of selling more Doritos. So as we approach high occult holidays and we close out our Food World Order coverage by scaring the crap out of you with horror, we move to holyhexes.com. We'll begin with the 1020 pop occulture news purge, versions, evictions, and the netherworld. We have links to BeliefNet, as well as the Huffington Post, on the King James Bible at 400 years continues to inspire. British media and theaters, that are live theaters, celebrate the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. Now, to flesh out this story, and again, as we have to constantly say, you may not believe in religion or any of this, but there are a bajillion people who do, and they are going to affect all our lives. We'll get into the story of King James Version, which is celebrating this year its 400th birthday. 1611 to 2011. Now, despite what this clip, I believe, may say, other sources paint it more accurately with regards to the date. May 1st, 1611, the King James Bible.
At the start of the 16th century, only one version of the Bible was allowed in England, the Latin Vulgate. But in 1526, a man named William Tyndale defied both the king and the pope and published a new English translation of the New Testament, the first one ever to use the original Greek sources. He had translated about half the Old Testament from Hebrew when he was arrested and sentenced to death. In 1536, Tyndale was burned at the stake. But even in the midst of the fire, he died with a prayer on his lips.
Lord, open the King of England's eyes!
William Tyndale's prayer was answered almost 80 years later when a new king took the throne and commissioned an English Bible that would become the greatest selling book of all time and change the English language forever. In 1603, Queen Elizabeth died, leaving the British throne to her second cousin, James, the King of Scotland. For the new king, expectations were high. James needed to find a way to step out of Elizabeth's shadow and make his own mark, and he found it in a most unlikely place. When James took the throne, the Church of England was plagued by controversy and corruption. So in 1604, he called a meeting with the bickering church leaders, both the Anglican bishops and the Puritans who wanted to reform them. The Hampton Court Conference was supposed to unify the church, but with everyone competing for the new king's attention, the meeting turned into chaos.
Do you have any other worthy requests? And I mean truly worthy of my attention.
Much of the fighting was focused on England's two Bibles. The Puritans favored the Geneva translation. It was the most popular Bible in England, but it was full of marginal notes that criticized the church and the crown. In response, the bishops published their own Bible, an inferior translation mandated for use in the Church of England. James didn't care for either Bible. So Puritan leader John Reynolds made a suggestion.
There should be one translation of the Bible to be authenticated and read in the churches.
There is a Bible.
Hated by all the people and the work of dunces.
It's a bishop's Bible.
Unacceptable to these worthy scholars.
Go on.
One version to be read throughout the land, unifying our worship.
We will have a new translation. And you, humble servants of Almighty God, will all work together.
The translation took 7 years and brought together 47 of England's best Greek and Hebrew scholars. More than 80% of their work was based on the work of William Tyndale, who had given his life for the Bible 75 years earlier. The result was the most accurate translation in England's history.
One marvels at how a project by committee can sing with the same voice, with the same sense of diction, clarity, and eloquence.
On May 2nd, 1611, the King James Bible was printed, and for the first time, the English people had the same Bible, both at church and at home.
There's no question that the King James Version literally shaped the English language. To this day, we have 257 idioms that come out of the King James.
Among them, sour grapes, a fly in the ointment, and a wolf in sheep's clothing. Plus, have you ever seen eye to eye with someone? Wondered whether a leopard can change his spots or escape by the skin of your teeth? All of these phrases came from the King James Bible.
The impact of King James is dramatic. The rhetoric, the poetry, the prose, the syntax is also high that it remains the standard for English language.
That's a revolutionary document, and it has shaped Western culture.
King James never lived to see the worldwide success of the Bible he commissioned. The rest of his reign was marked by scandal and political turmoil. And just 14 years later, he died. But James left a legacy that reached far beyond the British Isles. Since 1611, the Bible has gone around the world in more than 4,000 languages. But the task of translation is not complete.
More than 300 million people speaking over 2,000 languages still don't have a Bible. As we celebrate the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, let us pray that all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues can have a Bible to open their eyes and to turn them from darkness to light.
Amen. Ra. Montana government evicts Jesus statue from the park. Susan Sarandon says Pope Benedict is a Nazi. Tibetan nun dies by self-immolation. And a Penang temple medium commissioned to sell the iPhone in the netherworld by the reincarnation of Steve Jobs. Furthermore, on HolyHexes.com, the Order of the Illuminati, its origins, methods, and influence on world events. This article, not from VigilantCitizen.com, but from its sister site, Secret Arcana. GOP presidential hopeful courts pagans. From The Hill, Gary Johnson's unorthodox campaign for the Republican presidential nomination continued last Sunday when he spoke at a Google Plus town hall conducted by representatives of various pagan media outlets such as Pagan Newswire Collective, Modern Witch Podcast, and Patheos.com, who have the full transcript available at Patheos.org. Murders of Peruvian shaman investigated, with the mayor as the lead suspect. The Peruvian government sending a team of officials to a remote region in the Amazon jungle to investigate the deaths of 14 shamans who were killed in a string of brutal murders. The traditional healers, all from the Shawi ethnic group, were murdered in separate incidents over the last 20 months, allegedly at the behest of the mayor. We also ask and find out why Friday the 13th is unlucky, with King Philip IV of France and Jacques de Molay and Pope Clement V and October 13th, 1307. All excerpted from Catherine Kurtz's Tales of the Knights Templar. And we have discussed Friday the 13th in the past when the 13th falls on show day. We also have the secret belief, or rather beliefs, of Mormons, and more on that from CNET. And we also ask, who built the Georgia Guidestones, part of the Sinister Sites series from VigilantCitizen.com. And as we reach the end, my friend, again, we're approaching noon Pacific time, October 21st, 2011, in Portland, Oregon. And I don't believe the rapture has taken place just yet. You remember the May 21st date. That was just the setup. Harold Camping's prediction had always been October 21st. But let's tie it in with something else we may have forgotten, my friends. Doomsday Comet Elenin passes quietly. October 21st prediction up next from Christian Post. The Doomsday Comet Elenin, which some predicted would usher in the end of the world with a series of tsunamis and earthquakes, glided past Earth on Sunday, October 16th, in several tiny pieces. The Discovery News website classified the predicted Doomsday Comet as being a product of, quote, overactive imaginations of some conspiracy theorists, end quote. NASA issued a Q&A entitled Everything You Ever Needed to Know About Elenin to quell doomsday speculation. Quote, most comets pose no threat to Earth. Elenin is not an exception, read the Jet Propulsion Laboratory website. And anytime we mention Jet Propulsion Laboratory, we want to mention Jack Parsons' laboratory.
John Whiteside Parsons, chemist and rocket engineer extraordinaire, was the actual creator of the Caltech lab, eventually called JPL. Or, among insiders, Jack Parsons' lab. And while there is very little official biographical information to be found on him in the general literature, it is a curious fact that most of his papers and books are still classified by the Department of Defense. One thing that is known, at least within the planetary science community, is that Parsons has been officially immortalized by the International Astronomical Union by having a crater named for him on the moon. It is therefore extremely puzzling that the rest of Parsons' life, in comparison to far more obscure space scientists and engineers, is relatively unknown, even among avid JPL enthusiasts. Perhaps the reason for this paucity of information has something, perhaps a lot, to do with certain aspects of Parsons' private life that most at NASA and JPL, actually in the know, might rather be forgotten. Because one striking aspect of Parsons' private life that has been well documented outside of official governmental sources and publications is his curious association with an individual known as Aleister Crowley. Given Crowley's overwhelming and intensely controversial interests, the demonstrable importance of Crowley in Jack Parsons' private and professional life, stay tuned, and an inexplicable Crowleyan pattern that has recently emerged in all JPL missions, one feels compelled to ask at this late date, who was Aleister Crowley? And what was his heretofore unseen, but apparently highly influential role in the founding and evolution of this critical national space facility called JPL? Aleister Crowley was the premier self-styled Western magician of the 20th century, who some have called the most evil man in the world. Crowley simply termed himself the Great Beast. He wouldn't invite him to dinner. Whose secret name in his order was Phoenix, for reasons that will later become apparent. Parsons became one of Crowley's greatest students and was said to have been his personally chosen successor. Let me repeat that. We have documentation, no question, that Parsons was selected by Crowley to be his successor in these arcane magical rituals and ceremonies and practices. Which is not something you're going to get from a NASA press release, all right? Parsons quickly moved up the ranks of Crowley's organization called the Order of the Eastern Temple and was eventually appointed head of the lodge in Pasadena by Crowley himself. Parsons swore an oath of allegiance to guide humanity into, quote, an age of communion with the gods. Is this something you're going to read in NASA's official stuff? Using his demonstrable vast talents of insight and science and, in his own words, magic. The objectives of those like Crowley who practice Western magic is ostensibly, quote, to advance humanity by contact with higher intelligence. That is, read with extraterrestrials. Gosh, is that what they're up to?
Elenin was closest to Earth at 22 million miles away, more than 90 times the distance of the Moon from the Earth on the evening of October 16th. But this isn't the only end-of-the-world prediction in current circulation. Christian radio broadcaster Harold Camping predicted the end of the world will come Friday, today, October 21st, 2011. His prediction is similar to that of the comets in that he, too, claims the world will be destroyed by a succession of earthquakes on October 21st. And we have seen earthquakes all around the world, off the coast of California, off the coast of Oregon, in Texas, on Hawaii, Ring of Fire. We can be sure that the whole world, with the exception of those who are presently saved, the elect, are under the judgment of God and will be annihilated together with the whole physical world on October 21st, 2011, Camping said in a statement. According to ITN News, geologists have confirmed that 10 earthquakes happened millions of years ago on October 21st, but they also noted that several million earthquakes occur every year. Camping has previously predicted three doomsdays, the most recent being on May 21st, 2011. For the May 21st doomsday, Camping originally predicted the end of the world would include a rapture of 200 million Christians, born-again Christians, caught up in the clouds. And there would be natural disasters for multiple days, including fires, earthquakes, plagues, before God destroys the world. Camping changed his tune, predicting that the October 21st rapture will be quick and there will be no pain for non-believers. NASA contends that not only was Elenin in no way going to affect life on Earth, but in fact is small compared to previous comets, being described as a modest size icy dirt ball by NASA scientist Don Yeomans. We add in a lot of supplemental reading with all the flashbacks to holyhexes.com, links to familyradio.com, The Washington Post, jpl.nasa.gov, discovery.com, and so much more, my friends, as the doomsday comet Elenin passed quietly on the 16th, and we are sitting here soaking on October 21st for a rapture. Just about out of time, my friends. Let's glance back at the breaking news as things are moving very, very quickly. Libya plans secret Gaddafi burial. Obama announces end of Iraq war, troops to return home by end of the year, and everything will be fine. Oh, let's get our rapture clip.
Harold Camping was forced to apologize when he said the world was going to end on May the 21st, because it didn't.
People want me to apologize. I can apologize. Yes, I did not have all of that worked out as accurately as I should have, or I wish I could have had it.
But his apology was a little hollow. He claimed he was a mere 5 months out, and that his May prediction, in fact, marked a spiritual end.
It was to be understood spiritually, not physically.
But now, the 90-year-old's new apocalyptic date is upon us. And Camping says the rapture's actually going to get underway on Friday, the 21st of October.
We've already been talking again and again about the end of the world being October 21 in 2011.
The family radio preacher says his new date is probably firm, but many people won't be holding their breath. Harold Camping has a CV of previous apocalyptic predictions, and so far, none have come true.
And there you have it, my friends. The rapture, the end of the war, and everything will be fine. It's episode 236, October 21st, 2011. My name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com. Thanking you for spending your mind time with me. And again, your support helps keep Media Monarchy growing and going. And I thank you for spreading the word about this show. Just a quick word, you won't believe what next week is. You guys must join me here October 28th, 2011 for episode 237 of MediaMonarchy.com. But we're going to go out as long as we're discussing the King James Version, one of the most slept on power pop records. It's one of my favorites. It's from the year 2000 and it's called King James Version, and it's from the Seattle band Harvey Danger. This is the thrilling conversation you've been waiting for. Take care.
There is a price tag.
MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRAradio.org, the World Network video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news clips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation or mail Media to the Monarchy at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.